Hello, welcome again to Comic Connoisseurs. Tonight we'll be talking about post-crisis Superboy, Kal-El, before other less talented writers ruined him. Hey, yours to my co-host, J.T. from Saskatoon.
You're making me evil!
And also with us is Superboy fan, Red Ink.
Previously on X-Men.
Your morph. Anyways, let's get started as we usually do with the solicitations. So, let's see here. Anyone see anything from Amigo Comics you want to talk about?
I need that list.
I gave you the list. There's a list. Okay.
I've never read anything from Amigo, honestly. Although, like, I think we mentioned Ghost Wolf number one in a previous podcast, and I'd probably check that out just based on the title alone.
What's it about?
According to Ghost Wolf number two, in the Northern Waste, two demigods have their final showdown. The Ghost Wolf, avatar of the tribe, versus Kurenos, the horn god who feeds on the dead.
I see.
I'm sold.
That's like a webcomic being published.
Yeah. Very well might be. Moving on, we got... okay, I'm just going to have to check out from Antarctic Press. I'm going to have to check out 32-Bit Zombie just because...
Is it because of the title?
Yeah.
Ah.
I enjoy reading a comic named Zombie Tramp. It should be no surprise to anyone that I'm going to read 32-Bit Zombie.
Speaking of zombies, we have Afterlife with Archie, Volume 1, Escape from Riverdale.
Ah. Yeah, I read online, apparently because of the success that they're having with Afterlife with Archie, they're making another horror-themed Archie book come the fall.
They're making Sabrina a horror.
Yeah, yeah.
Sabrina meets Carrie?
Something like that. It's Sabrina, but it's more somewhere, I guess it's closer in the realm, from the description I read, it's closer to the realm of, like, Buffy, in terms of that, you know, she's a witch, and there's, you know, ghosts and ghouls and goblins, but it's not all lovey-dovey the way classic Sabrina is.
Mm. Going through the motions?
Yeah. Sonic Universe, World of Archie. It shouldn't be surprising anyone. I mean, you used to have, what, Archie's Laughing, Archie's Madhouse, Life with Archie, Archie and Pals.
Everything's Archie.
Yeah. Archie's Bet Friend, Jughead. I mean... Even in his own title, Jughead had second billing. What do you got?
We got Avatar. We got Avatar Press.
Yeah, home of Garth Ennis.
Yes.
Boom Studios. There is a number one. If you do not have any interest in reading this comic, Ben, we're done.
I love Big Trouble in Little China, the movie.
Thank you.
I just don't know how it would translate as a comic book.
Well, was it being written by Eric Powell, creator of The Goon, so...
That is true.
And with Eric Powell and John Carpenter's helping with the writing on that, so... And seriously, if there is one guy that would hit the right tone with the comic books, it would probably be the creator of The Goon. I mean, there have been other... Previous to this, there was some very short-lived, independent... You know, The Adventures of Jack Burton... Sort of that was the name of the comic, and it was so bad. Like it's not like the movie where, you know, Jack is very clearly in the beginning the sidekick and he becomes his own hero by the end of the film. No, it's literally these comic books just play Jack as this bumbling idiot more so than he is in the film. It was just horrible.
So let's move on here. Got some Dark Horse, it's more Buffy and Angel comics, and Dragon Age, and
Lobster Johnson,
we got more Mass Effect comics, about the universe already destroyed, if you want to read it again.
Nexus, which I've only ever read like three or four Nexus comics, but really enjoyed that sort of stuff. It's like really good writing with the whole, like, where he's... God, I haven't read the news. He's basically drafted, become like this universe-spanning, like, judge, jury, executioner sort of thing. Or maybe I'm misremembering the story. Like I said, I remember reading them and enjoying them. It's been ages.
All right, then we have DC Comics, and moving on, we have Dynamite.
There's one in DC we could talk about that you might even enjoy. Batman Meets the Green Hornet.
Batman 66 meets the Green Hornet.
Yeah, but you know what I mean.
And we got Bruce Lee
back. The real Kato. Because I got some friends of mine that, look, I like the Seth Rogen movie, but that's not the Green Hornet that I know and love. The Green Hornet I know and love is Van Williams and Bruce the motherfucking Dragon Lee in the 1960s. That is Kato. That is Green Hornet, you know. Although some of the Mark Waid stuff has been done really good, too. But I'm just saying, and this is basically a sequel to the crossover they had in the TV show.
Yes, the one that says that Burt Ward could fight on par with Bruce Lee, yes.
Yeah, I found those episodes on YouTube a while ago, and I remember watching through the series. And when I watched that episode, I was just snickering the whole time, because, yeah, Robin's going to kick Kato's ass. Never mind Burt Ward's going to beat Bruce Lee, just Robin's going to beat Kato? I don't think so.
See, the thing is, in Asia, Green Hornet was called the Kato Show.
Well, he did most of the work.
And everyone was like, oh, it's the Kato Show!
Who doesn't know that, though?
True.
Okay. Anyways, let's see here. We got Dynamite.
Nary a Jimmy J.J. Walker in sight.
With a Red Sonja number one.
New Vampirella.
What's so new about her?
It's a new comic.
I think she has a couple of new additions to her.
Ooh, I'm gonna get the. I'm a huge fan of the Dotson's art, so I'll probably get the Dotson alternate cover.
Man of Bronze, Doc Savage, number six. Let's move on here. We got some IDW with G.I. Joe, Real American Hero, and Judge Dredd.
PMNT. New Ninja Turtles. Actually, that new series has been pretty good. I mean, as far as taking a different take on the origins and all that, it's something that they haven't done before. Instead of just, I mean, it's a rat. They've done the whole rat, and they just get and turtles get exposed to the mutagen, and they, you know, become hideously deformed creatures of superhuman size and strength. The twist of their origins and the whole father-son dynamic between Splinter and his sons, you know, I don't want to spoil it for people because I think it's a really cool twist, and I would highly recommend it to people.
Okay. Well, we got Image Comics here. I'm not really seeing anything in the Image Comics I want to talk about.
And just five ghosts.
Michael Turner Witchblade cover. How'd they do that?
Oh, it's probably an old one.
Okay.
Yeah, but the only thing in here, like I said, I've said it before, I said it again, people, go out and read Five Goats. If you have any love for Pulp Fiction and just some Flash Gordon, Doc Savage style, just pulp adventure, you do yourself a disservice not reading it.
All right, let's see here. We got Marvel Comics here. We got some Punisher. We got some other things.
The Loki Agent of Asgard title has been a lot of fun.
So we have Miles Morales, The Ultimate Spider-Man, number two, which reveals Peter Parker is alive.
Well, they haven't technically revealed these.
At this point, it's still up in the other whether this is really Peter Parker or it's another clone, which, in all fairness, it's a 50-50 shot at best until they explicitly say.
Red, do your thing.
I know the theory. I know the theory of which you speak, but I'm just saying in the story at this point, you know, maybe it is Peter, maybe it isn't, but Bendis isn't writing this. Oh, wait, he is. Never mind.
Yeah.
Fuck this guy.
Instead of going on a huge, long, two-hour rant and telling you about this theory, I'll just sum it down to, I think the Peter Parker that died was a Carnage clone.
I don't disagree with that. It's like if they bring him back like that, it's such a cheap cop-out.
Like, Spider-Man continuity doesn't have a lot of those.
I'm just saying.
All right, let's move further down the list, we got the, you know, no new Thunderbolts this week. I think that was actually last week.
Yeah.
That horrible Moon Knight comment.
You don't like Thunderbolts Red?
No. I don't like a team where everybody's red.
Okay, Red.
Sorry, that's just brilliant.
I knew it was coming.
Okay. We got Valiant Entertainment. Nothing I really see here that interests me. Yeah.
The only thing I read from Valiant is Archer and Armstrong, so...
Okay, so looks like we are done with the solicitations this week. We'll take a brief break, and when we come back, we will have the topic of the show.
It's time for intermission, boys and girls.
Like animation? Come listen to Animation Aficionados.
And if you disagree with us, you could be a guest on a future show.
Available on iTunes, the Zune Market, and... AnimationAficionados.com.
Hey, I'm Gary.
I'm Mike.
I'm Chuck.
And I'm Justin.
Join the four of us every week on the internet's number one and longest running G.I. Joe podcast, What's on Joe Mind?
It's Joe news, reviews, and interviews like you've never heard them before, delivered right to your MP3 player.
Our guests include Jason Marsden, Kevin Michael Richardson, and Matt Yang King from G.I. Joe Renegades, Larry Hama, Robert Adkins, and John Barber from IDW Publishing, and many more from around the online Joe community.
Yeah, it's guys talking about Joe. Think of it as Joe Talk meets Sports Talk. And we make fun of Chuck.
Right, and we... Hey, again?
Come on, Chuck. We're just kidding, kinda.
Sometimes Chuck makes fun of himself.
Right, and we... Okay, seriously, this is just getting ridiculous now.
It's What's on Joe Mind, every week on the GeekCast Radio Network, InsidePulse.com, Stitcher Smart Radio, and iTunes. Download and listen today.
I suppose I still can't say something about Transformers, can I?
Good. No.
What about sports?
That sounds
good. Yeah, that's all right.
It's action. It's drama. It's comedy. It's DeCian, the superhero webcomic. DeCian's got superhero antics and sexy girls. Read it now at DeCian.com. DASIEN.com.
And now, back to the show.
And we're back to talk about Post-Crisis Superboy Kal-El before other less talented writers ruined him. I think I said this many times before, but I'm going to say it again, is Post-Crisis Superboy Kal-El, as created and envisioned by Carl Kessel and Tom Grummett, was the character that got me interested in comic books again as a child. He was a character that I loved to read. I picked up pretty much every appearance he ever had up to a certain point, and I'm going to get to where that point is later in the show. The way he was written, the way that he had to deal with his heritage, was something I really enjoyed. And it was something that really spoke to me, evoked to me, about how he became a part of the Superman legacy. Not because he was not related to Superman. He did not become a part of the Superman legacy and the Superman family because, oh, he's a clone. Because he wasn't. He became it because he was, because of his... desire, because of his strength, because of his power, because he wanted to be good enough to be part of that legacy. That's why. And that's what part of what really spoke about this character to me. To go back to the beginning, Death of Superman is when this character was originally created. Go ahead, Red.
The Reign of the Superman?
Reign of the Superman, yes. Because back in the day, Superman ran in 4 books a month. So technically, you could go each week reading a different Superman adventure. And the writers, once a year, got together and had a powwow where they're like, okay, well, what's the big storyline this year? What are we working on this year? So that way they could get everything in sync, get everything together. And every year... one of the writers would jokingly say, well, let's kill him this year. And this is the first year where they go, versus just a laugh. And thing is, when Superman died, there each creative team of, you know, Superman, Adventures of Superman, Man of Steel, and Action Comics, those were the 4 titles, each team you know, they were basically told, okay, what's your idea of how Superman can come back? It was like, and each team had a different idea, and they're like, okay, you get to run with your idea. Of course, there was lots of cross promotional and lots of working with these teams together, but that's essentially the idea. So you have the Eradicator, you know, the last son of Krypton was one of these versions. You had Steel, back then just Man of Steel, you know, John Henry Irons in the armor suit. You had Cyborg Superman, and finally you had Superboy.
The Metropolis
Kid. But don't call him that.
But yes, the Metropolis Kid. And Superboy really came from Cadmus, which was another long-lasting strand in the Superman mythos. I would say super long-lasting, but it was a Kirby addition to the Superman mythos. And funny thing is, when Kirby created Cadmus, he didn't call it Cadmus. He called it The Project.
Or the DNA Project, right?
That's correct. And the idea of basically the original Newsboy Legion grew up, became super scientists, created clones of themselves, which is the new Newsboy Legion, you know, gave a clone body to their guardian, the Golden Guardian, Jim Harper, another one of my favorite characters. And I'm sorry, I really love these characters a lot.
They're pushing really... them so...
What?
So they're pushing them so hard on people back then.
Well, true, but you know, I enjoyed them all, and you know, with the Golden Guardian and everything, the idea of Superboy is Cadmus actually did succeed in stealing Superman's body, but they found that Kryptonian DNA was impossible to clone. But they did study it, and they did also study Superman's dead body and found that it had this impermeable aura around it, which was Superman's invulnerability. So what they found was they could take human DNA and make it as Kryptonian as possible, which was back in the 90s, Superman's DNA was a triple helix versus a humanoid double helix. Don't ask, I don't really understand. And what he did was, Superboy does technically have a triple helix DNA, but it is based off of human genetic material. And they made it look as Kryptonian as possible and gave Superboy the power of this energy aura, which became...
Tactile telekinesis.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, love it.
And but you have to go back to what tactile telekinesis originally was, too.
Yes.
So you actually have to be in physical contact with something to affect it.
Well, back in the day, a lot of people had theories of what Superman's powers actually were, like how he'd fly and all that shit.
How he could lift something heavy and not have it crumble over its own weight.
Yeah, and then people basically came up with tactile telekinesis. That was the answer.
The idea was his aura extends over anything he touches, so that's why he can lift a heavy object and it doesn't crumble apart.
Yeah, and that was a fan theory, originally.
That is true. This is a fan theory.
Yeah, and but, DC Comics basically came up with the bioelectric aura after that.
Yes, which explains why his costume doesn't get shredded, but sometimes his cape does.
Yeah.
And so the tactile telekinesis was the only power that Superboy originally had, but this one power could simulate every power. Well, not every power, but most of Superman's powers, from the invulnerability, flight.
He got the 3D shades in that eventually.
He did get 3D shades, but that's another story.
Well, on the match story, it was revealed that Superboy's power, the tactile telekinesis, can simulate everything Superman can do.
That is true. Actually, the thing is in a Cadmus story, they found that he has other unactivated genes. And several of these genes were theorized to be stuff for, like, heat vision and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
See, what Match actually does wasn't really heat vision. Sometimes the colorist did it as heat vision, but Carl Kessel was very clear that it was more like a force vision.
It was like a pyrokinetic blast.
Yes. So the idea of heat vision is something that was actually addressed in the comics was they said that this mutant had several unactivated genes because of his face. And these genes would later become activated and give him heat vision.
But yeah, because, I mean, he never... They eventually... Didn't they wipe that out when they had the whole clone virus thing?
We're going to talk about that later.
Well, no, I'm just saying, because when talking about his powers, because at one point, didn't they say that his genes becoming active later on were negated because they had that whole bit with the clone virus where he basically got, for a while, he was locked at age 16?
That is true.
And it appeared, and he wasn't going to age any further.
That is true. That was a good ways in the original Kessel run. But we're back to the beginning of where he wasn't even called Superboy yet. Basically, he was the Metropolis kid and he insisted to be called Superman. And the thing that they got right here, that every other clone story got wrong ever since, is Superboy has no memories of anybody, of any of his predecessors. He doesn't have... The thing that's revealed is Superboy is based off of, you know, his original genetic donor was the evil director of Cadmus at the time, Paul Westfield. But he doesn't have the genetic memories of Paul Westfield because genetic memories don't exist. Because that's blah-blah cycle bullshit that sells Assassin's Creed games. But that's another thing that's very important is in the original comics, you actually see a scene during Reign of the Superman where Lois is talking to Martha back when they thought Superboy was a clone of Clark. And Martha makes a statement of, you know, no boy we would raise would ever act like that. And Lois says, but that's the thing, Martha, you didn't raise this boy. Do you know what a clone is?
Yeah.
And that to me was a great scene because that's like, yes, duh, finally someone gets it. You can't clone somebody and they wake up with all the memories. That does not happen.
Well, cloning doesn't happen, so how do you know?
Okay, yes, you're right, Red. But back when they were at least trying to pretend they knew science, you know?
Yeah.
And Superboy first started as having a couple of adventures in Metropolis. After Superman comes back, he is allowed to keep the shield with him. He is allowed to operate under the name of Superboy, and he decides that he wants to go to Hawaii. Because why not?
Yeah.
And the first Hawaii part has a couple of interesting things. One of the things I loved was Superboy had his own Turk. Yeah, there was this character named Sidearm.
I can't remember.
Yes, there was this villain character that Superboy kept on running into named Sidearm, whose power was he had these robotic arms, and Superboy always easily beats him in some hilarious fashion every time he meets him, and this brings me to Superboy number zero. Superboy number zero was the first issue of him in Hawaii, where he is examined by Dr. Emil Hamilton of Star Labs with Superman there, and they reveal several things that are important to the Kal-El Superboy mythos. Number one, he's a human. Number two, he's not a clone of Superman. Number three, his genetic material was made to look as Kryptonian as possible. And these are things that are stated clearly on the paper.
Yeah.
And I've actually gotten to arguments with people about this where they refute, where I held the book. I said, here, read the book. I have the book right here. Geoff Johns made changes. And it's like, I'm not going to read that. It's like, why? You just said that you're confident that he was always a half human, half Kryptonian clone. Here's the book that says he wasn't. He's like, oh, look, I've actually had someone refuse to read the book I had in my hands.
But Superboy Prime
seriously
punched reality and changed.
Oh, fuck that.
And by the way, just so you know, Red, I will not refer... I will never use that name when referring to that particular character.
Super Bitch Prime.
In my eyes, it's Super Bitch Prime or nothing at all. Because that's all he is. He's a super bitch.
Prime. But, in the point remains is is the character as he was originally created was a very fun-loving character. It's basically, I'm young, I have powers, I'm a teenager, I'm happening, you know, let's enjoy the party. But at the same time, with a sense of responsibility, a sense of duty, a sense of attitude that really spoke to me. Red?
Well, it's similar for me, too. I basically, it was one of my favorite comics growing up as well. And for me, I had a limited choice of comics to read at the time because I lived in a small little town and a gas station basically got all the comics. And one of the ones that always came in was Superboy. And once I read it, I pretty much fell in love with it. It was a character, what I loved about it was a character who was trying to prove himself.
Exactly.
Like, he wasn't Superman at all. When the beginning, when he started, when he was a Metropolis kid, even in the beginning of his series, he was a complete asshole. He was an arrogant douchebag. He changed slowly over time to be a fucking complete human being, to be a good person. And when Superman pretty much drops him off in Hawaii in the beginning, he's like, you can keep the shield. You can call yourself Superboy. You earn the name Superboy. But he doesn't say he earned the shield. That's one of the things that kind of stuck with me, too, in the beginning. Then over time, he does earn the shield. And then he does earn a Kryptonian name.
Yes.
Slowly.
Go ahead, sorry.
He slowly proves himself over the space of the comic. And yes. That's what I loved. I love it when the writer basically changes the character and keeps with it, keeps continuity, because it just shows that they give a shit about the character and they give a shit about the writing.
And one of my favorite parts of that is the story where Superboy gets invited to, because the thing is, for the longest time, his name was Superboy, because he had no other name. He had that one Carl Crummett issue, but that doesn't count. But there was an issue where Superboy gets invited to the Fortress of Solitude, and he plugs into this VR thing, where he relives the memories of one of Superman's ancestors. And the lesson about this was not only was this a lesson about the dangers of genetic modification and cloning, but this was also to help Superboy understand his own identity. And Superman gave him the name Kal-El and said, "You're my cousin now. You're my cousin Kal-El."
They have that where they basically both kind of break down and they hug it out, which one of the more, and I don't say this often about comics, it's one of the more emotional stories ever read, because you see the effect on Superboy, and it's a great credit to Tom Grummett's art, because you see that breaking down of walls of him finally, you know, realizing he's not alone. Yeah, he's got a home, he's got family, he's got, not that he didn't have people who loved him before, but, you know, it's one thing to have friends who are your family, and it's another to have, like, an actual family. So, I mean, that was one of my favorite stories.
One of the biggest underrated threats in the DC universe that never came up again, because no other writer has the balls to do this character, Black Zero. And more importantly, one of my favorite arcs in the Superboy storyline, the hypertension storyline, where the story starts with a dead Superboy plops into Cadmus wearing this weird jacket. And it turns out that this Superboy is not a clone of the current Superboy, but is a Superboy from another dimension. And this jacket sends Superboy to these other dimensions. And the first dimension he visits is the pre-crisis world, where he meets Silver Age Superboy Clark Kent. And there's this great scene.
Before you get into that, Ben, how did they launch him into hypertime?
On a nuclear missile.
They strap him. They run wires into it because this thing apparently uses some super advanced form of fusion. I think it was, yeah. And they don't fire a nuke at him, but I just love that. Yeah, it's the reason I bring that up is, like, that's why I love comics. I love pants on head crazy shit like that.
And like
I've got to travel to another dimension.
And like I said, the first world he visits is pre-Crisis Superboy, Clark Kent. And the thing is, you have this great scene where they're both at Ma and Pa Kent's place and they're talking. And Superboy, Connell realizes his Superman is Clark Kent. And it's like, he gets a little upset because he's like, because he actually gets really down. He's like, why didn't he tell me? Why didn't he tell me? And, but to his credit, pre-Crisis Superboy actually tries to explain it. He's like, well, if I was Superman, I would want you to look up to me, so I wouldn't tell you. And I thought that was a really nice moment where, this almost transcending moment where the ideal Superman passes through. And it's those kind of moments I look for in comics.
Yeah. And then he goes on through like these other alternate worlds.
And let's talk about Black Zero for a second, because Black Zero, like I said, is probably one of the greatest threats that was created in the DC universe. And the fact that he's ignored and never used again by any writer shows that they don't care for the work of Carl Kessel and Tom Grummett. Because we're talking about a guy who fucking beat up and knocked out a pre-Crisis Kryptonian with his bare hands.
This is true. I mean, the whole idea, and the idea about Black Zero, because this is basically what, it's basically in a world like, what if the death of, the return of Superman never happens? So Superman dies.
And what if the Superman clone...
What if Cadmus's plan had actually been pulled off?
Yeah, what if he didn't get knocked out of the pod early? What if he was grown to adulthood?
Yeah.
And I actually like that story a lot because it showed lots of what Superman was talking about with the idea of genetically modified people being persecuted, as was on Krypton, the Black Zero movement, and Black Zero in the ultimate version of Superboy taking the name Black Zero. I mean, like I said, this is one of the greatest villains I've seen created by anyone in DC Comics, and to be similarly ignored is just kind of a shame. Of course, this is the story that also has the challenges of the unknown, so I already love it. So,
well, and it's also one of the best things about the hypertension story is it was a really, I don't want to say subtle, but I thought it was a particularly clever way to reintroduce the concept of the multiverse to DC Comics. Because, I mean, for years after Crisis on Infinite Earths, it's like, that's it, one Earth, one timeline, no alternate versions. Everything else is just an extra story we put out this month. But now they open this door, and it ties into, like, Kingdom Come and its sequel, The Kingdom, in that hyper-time.
Nothing happened and everything happens at the same time.
Exactly. And you can certainly visit other realities, but you can't stay that long, because they mention that in the story. I think it was in the Superboy story. It might have been in the Kingdom, where you can only be in a separate timeline universe for so long before shit starts going south again.
Yes.
So you can visit, but you can't live there. And I really love that. And then they set up with the Challengers. They set up this great story. I wish they would have gone... Well, they never really explored it too much. That's the thing. Like, they have the idea that, Red was lost in the time stream, and...
One of the other members was placed with an alternate version.
June, like the sixth, or no, the fifth, the now now official, fifth Chal, as they call him, fifth Challenger of the Unknown. And they could have spun that idea off into an ongoing series. I mean, it wasn't... I think, is this after Zero Hour?
This was after Zero Hour, because Zero Hour happened around Superboy number 8, Superboy number 8 was when Superboy first met pre-Crisis Superboy.
Yeah, but it's and I mean, because
we're in like the '60s right now in the Superboy.
Yeah, no, I was going to mention that just with the Zero Hour, they had come out with kind of more of an X-Files influenced Challenger's Own, which had some really good stories, but then they went and crapped all over the legacy of the Challengers with explaining the living on borrowed time, which living the challenges in knowing the living on borrowed time. Sorry, quick tangent. Explaining that is like explaining how immortality works in the Highlander movie, because there's only one Highlander movie. Don't let anyone tell you different.
Because shut and up.
Exactly reasons. It's just it. You can't take the mystery out of something like that. If you explain how Connor McLeod and the Kurgan can die and come back, and if you say that they're aliens from another planet and they've traveled back in time, suck start a shotgun. I apologize for the darkness of that statement, but that's how I feel about
but
that.
But back to Superboy.
Back to Superboy. It's just Hypertension was a great story, and some really, really good art, like almost perfect by Tom Grummett. Like, and I've met Tom Grummett a few times, and yes, Ben, we're not talking about that on the show. I've met him a few times, and great guy. I love. I was at a small comic convention here in town where I asked them, you know, like how they came up with the like how did they come up with you know the death of Superman? Well, they wanted him to get married, so they killed him instead.
No, what happened was part of it was like I said was every year they met and one guy always said, well, let's kill him this year. That was part of it. The other part of it was they were planning a marriage, but what happened was Warner Brothers
Lois and down, Clark.
Yeah, Warner Brothers came down and said, wait, we're not ready for the marriage on ours, and you got to delay it a year.
Yeah.
So that's what happened. But back to Superboy. I mean, the things I love is sometimes he was solo. Sometimes he was with Dublix, the DNA alien. Sometimes he was with the Golden Guardian, just called the Guardian back then. And sometimes he was a free agent. Sometimes he was with Cadmus. Sometimes he was with Young Justice. And by the way, I loved him with Young Justice, because the thing is, him with Bart Allen and Tim Drake, just some of the best comedy that writes itself.
Yeah, the id, the ego, and the super ego. Why aren't I the super ego?
See, you gotta do a Young Justice episode for this too, so we can talk.
Oh,
about
we will. We believe me, we will.
And you also gotta do a Young Justice episode for Animation Aficionados.
I don't think people want to listen to me saying fuck, fuck, fuck for an hour and a half.
But let's talk a little more about Superboy. Let's talk about some of the women in his life, because he actually had lots of interesting girlfriends. There was Knockout.
He had his own Lois Lane.
Tana Moon.
Yeah. Was it Tana or Tana?
I always thought Tana, but like I said, what I loved was Knockout, the Apocalypsian,
the female Fury.
Yeah, wasn't she a stripper?
She worked as a stripper.
Yes.
And in her gym bag, she carried not only her Knockout costume, which she didn't use on stage apparently. She also carried a lot of weights around, because I remember there's one issue early in the series where she's walking out of the bar and there's a drunk sailor there. It's like, oh, let me help you with your bag. And, oh, Jesus. And he's like, what are you carrying in there?
She took a quiet shine to Artina Steele. And the thing is, I love her nickname for him, too. She called him Pup.
Oh. That's just enough to give a certain teen of Steele an Oedipal complex. I'm just saying.
But the thing is, he is, sadly, our Superboy, Kal-El, could not really reform Knockout. He tried. It just didn't work. But the thing is, in Thai Pretension, we did meet a reformed Knockout that did sadly die at the hands of an army of Doomsdays.
And a great series.
Yes.
And then there's Roxy.
But let's talk. Yeah, there was Roxy. But Roxy was more like a sister.
I think this is one of those, like, best friends. You know, she wants more, and he's kind of he's pretty well oblivious to it.
But let's talk about the early in the series. Some young teenage fan wrote in to the editors and said, "Hey, have you revealed? Are you going to reveal Superboy's genetic donor yet? I have a theory. That's Lex Luthor." And Carl Kessler wrote very politely, "I'm sorry, but you're wrong."
No, what he actually says is, he doesn't ask what the genetic donor is. He says, "I have a cool idea what it could be.
Okay.
Said, my idea is that Superboy has two different genetic donors, Superman and Lex Luthor.
So
and then Carl Kessel and Grommet there told him, haha, no.
Yeah, and what happened later on with Jeff Johns, you know, in Teen Titans. Now, I know you're not a fan, Ben. We know this, so you don't have to go off on a rant here. I recognize the fact you don't like him. I'm not entirely fond of everything he's written either. I have agreed with you on the Green Lantern stuff. I have. The whole idea that they changed it like that, yeah, I didn't like it, but how they executed it, it was entertaining. It was entertaining.
Let me talk about why I didn't like it, because the thing is this. Paul Westfield was an asshole at the level of Lex Luthor. I mean, he's done some shit that if you've read the series, you'd cringe at, visibly cringe at. And so, my genetic donor, my daddy's a bad man, is damage Superboy already went through and dealt with and absolved himself of. So what this is retreading it again to make his own theory, quote-unquote, right. And let's also talk about some of the things that he introduced, because we're talking about Jeff Johns, and Jeff Johns was very infamous when he started the Teen Titans series when Young Justice was canceled. When he was asked very pointed questions at that Comic-Con that year, one of the questions was asked by a friend of mine, Kevin O'Connell, asked him, why did he change Bart Allen? And let me tell you what Jeff Johns said, quote, word for word. I didn't like him, so I changed him until I liked him. Okay, now let me tell you why, as a comic book writer coming in to someone else's playpen, why that is one of the worst things you can say. Because the thing is, you're not writing your own story. You're not writing your own thing. You're writing based off of the groundwork, the bricks of continuity that other people laid behind. When you want to write for pre-existing characters, you write knowing you're doing that. And if you want to change it up, you have to come up with something that is a retcon that makes reasonable situations work in the minds of the existing fans and just outright, you know, respects them at the same time. Jeff Johns did not do that. He did not pay attention to the fact that Superboy number 0 made very clear what his genetic structure was. He didn't pay attention to the last 90 issues of Superboy, the issues of Young Justice. He didn't pay attention to any of that. He just said, well, he's half human, half Kryptonian, now deal with it. And this is why I have a problem with him as a writer, because that's not respectful to him. That's not respectful to the writers that came before him. That's not respectful to the characters. I mean, quite simply.
All right, so let me ask you this. Let me ask you this. I will concede the whole half-human, half-Kryptonian thing. Other than it being cliched, and you probably saw it's coming a while wide that Lex Luthor was his human daddy, fine, I'll give you that. If he had said something, like with Kid Flash, if he had said something, I thought it was time for Impulse to grow up a little, would that make it any better for you? Instead of just flat out saying, I didn't like him, so I changed him till I like him. If he had said, if that was his reasoning, that he thought it was time for Impulse to grow up, would that have made it any better for you?
Well, it would have come off as somewhat professional.
Let me step in and say something.
Okay.
For me, I never met Jeff Johns. I never talked to him. I have no idea what the hell he said, even though, well, like Ben said, what I didn't like is how he changed Impulse. I didn't like Impulse getting a shotgun to the fucking knee and then basically going into a library and reading everything and then suddenly maturing. What I also didn't like is a huge change between Young Justice and Teen Titans. Suddenly in Teen Titans, everybody thought Bart was immature. Everybody was like, ew, get away from me. I don't like you anymore. I'm grown up now. Blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, couple books ago, maybe 3 months ago, when Young Justice, before it was canceled, everybody loved Bart because he was basically the light. When you entered a room, Bart entered the room, it was like turning on a light. He cheered everybody up. He was the team.
He was the emotional core of the team.
Yeah, he was the team morale. And then suddenly, for no reason, everybody hates him. That's what I didn't like. Even Bart hated himself, which was fucking dumb.
To me, like I said, part of it is the lack of respect to the previous creators that came before him. And there's the other thing is he wanted to play this whole Danny Luthor thing, Superboy shaving his head and going crazy to a key phrase bullshit. It's all these things that plays to this idea of he actually has Superboy having tendencies and urges to burn down his school and acting like he's fighting against the genetic memories of Lex Luthor and genetic tendencies of Lex Luthor. He have this issue where he's reading a stack of books about genetic memory and having this as his big ordeal through all these issues while having one of the worst costumes ever.
You didn't like the t-shirt and jeans?
I liked it when Kessel originally did it during the Powerless arc. But to be fair, he had boots and gloves with it.
So not so much that it was stupid, it's been done before?
It's been done better before. And
About Superboy in the Young Justice cartoon? I mean,
I still think he deserves an actual costume. And this comes to something that Neil said to me once, was he said, if you actually look at the Superboy costume that Kessel and Grummet created, it's not that bad a costume. You take the leather jacket off, and it actually is a pretty good costume.
I mean, he had it for the longest time, too. I mean, all the characters.
And the thing is, when Joe Kelly got the book after Kessel and gave him a really bad costume,
the streamlined version of what he had before.
Yeah, the thing is, I hated the Joe Kelly run, but Joe Kelly at least respected a little bit. Joe Kelly went back to the immature Superboy, which bugged me.
Was he writing it right up to the end where Superboy was a superintendent?
Yes. What happened was Carl Kessel got off the book in the late 70s. They had a 3-issue filler arc. And then after the filler arc, they had Joe Kelly take over the book. And with Joe Kelly just went into a direction where he's like, oh, immature Superboy again. And thing is this, I've read stuff by Joe Kelly that I like. But Joe Kelly at least made an attempt to go with what he understood with the character and not mess around too much. Because the Joe Kelly book run was just stupid. It wasn't god-awful like what Jeff Johns did in Teen Titans. Because what all Jeff Johns did when he did Teen Titans was try to make a show of how the former Young Justice members were inept versus the older Titan characters, at least early on. And then he started doing other stupid things with the book, like he had the fucking Super Friends characters show up with the fucking dog and all that bullshit.
Yeah, but it turned out it wasn't their dog, and ate Marvin.
Being unnecessarily dark doesn't make you a better writer.
Never said it did.
I know. I'm just stating a fact. And like I said, the fact that Jeff Johns pretty much came into a position of power, and he decided from this position of power to not respect the people who came before him. And like I said before, when you're writing a serial story off the backs of other people who created the foundation, you're supposed to respect that foundation. If you don't respect that foundation, how am I supposed to respect you as someone who's supposed to be a professional in this industry? I don't. So I don't respect Jeff Johns.
All right. Issues tabled. We won't bring it up again.
Okay.
Let's talk about some of the supervillains they had in the series.
Well, we had a humanoid shark guy.
King Shark, Scavenger, who... This is what happens when your grandpa has superpowers and develops senility kids. What was his main thing? Like he was scavenging all these arcane relics to fight some unknown enemy, but you never Did we ever find out who Scavenger was fighting against or waiting for?
I can't think of it. I don't think it was ever revealed, but
other things they had. There you go.
Well, other villains I liked was definitely I did enjoy Sidearm as this very lame Turk like character. I also enjoyed the.
What do you think of this? Is it Silverblade? Was that the one?
I also one of the villains Superboy dealt with was Match, and this is another thing.
Oh right,
Match was like this hypercharged Superboy clone that was made with the powers like turned up a little, and
he was essentially the Bizarro.
No, he wasn't. He was not Bizarro.
Well, not he Let's wasn't a thing. Bizarro, but I'm just saying he was the Bizarro to Superboy's Superman.
No, they actually had a Bizarro Superboy in one of the Zero issues. They had a Bizarro, which was a previous clone attempt, except this one was actually a Kryptonian clone. Because the thing is, Superboy was clone number 16. The thing is, you remember he has an earring? The original hole his earring was in was a tag that said 16. So he was attempt number 16 to make a Superman clone. And the Bizarro he fought was number 15.
Okay. Match
was a hypercharged copy of Superboy. With the powers fully realized, with glowing white skin and a yellow costume with this sun pattern on it. And the thing to remember about Match is Match used to try to use he's a clone Superboy as a mental weapon against him by saying, you know, you could become me and stuff like that. And after Superboy met Black Zero, that didn't really work anymore because, like, dude, I met what I could become. You're nothing. And the last really big time that Match showed up was in Sins of Youth,
which is one of the best fifth week events.
Where it's revealed for like five issues of Young Justice, it wasn't Superboy, it was Match posing as Superboy.
Yeah. Because they had that great scene, like, because the whole miniseries, it was, what, you know, was it Lagoon Man and Aqua Boy and Batman and Robin, where Tim Drake and Bruce Wayne are reversed, because all the Justice League are turned into teenagers, and
Young Justice is turned into adults, and
Justice Society, they're toddlers. And the only one that's, like, halfway adult out of the kids was, like, Steel, except he couldn't use his sledgehammer to save his life. But just in that first, I love Match's the whole thing where Superboy shows up, they're having this big, you know, justice, they're having this rally for teen superheroes in Washington DC where the adults are all ready to put no, we know what's best, go listen to your rap music, because there's old Justice, which are made up of the teenage sidekicks from the Golden Age, like Doibe Dickles and Dan the Dynamite, and then they're Wonder, I think it was Wonder Girl, was making a very impassioned speech, and then Match was like, they're all crazy, they're gonna kill everybody, run, and then Superboy flies in to take him out, but the damage is already done.
Yes.
And Match was, like, when I say he's one of the villains that I honestly like the least, because it's an evil clone Superboy. Like, the idea of Match, I wasn't a big fan of, but the execution was great.
Yeah, because
don't
Match
get me wrong.
Match is a sinister thing, and the thing is, when Match even jokes about having Wonder Girl cloned just so he could have a companion, just to sort of piss Superboy off even more. And one of the things that, like I said, this is Match's last true appearance. I say true appearance because another certain hack of a writer thought Match was always a Bizarro.
All right.
I only called him a Bizarro in the respect that he's like this clone of the character, the way Bizarro was.
I understand, but the thing is, Geoff Johns literally thought he was a Bizarro.
Well, we're not going to talk about Geoff Johns anymore, Ben. I mean,
okay.
I can see the vein throbbing in your temple through here, and this is over the internet with no actual picture. I can practically hear it. But like, pretty much, I can, you know, the waves of negativity are strong in this one. Like I said before, one of my favorite villains in the Superboy series, at least in the first couple of years when he was stationed in Hawaii, was it Silverblade? Is that the proper name?
I believe so.
And Silverblade was like this. Was he a cop or a professor? He's a professional something. Who? Silver Sword. There you go. He's this native Hawaiian. He's not a big fan of Superboy. You know, why is this, what do you call it, Heoli? Like, he's basically, why is this mainlander coming over here and, you know, propping himself up like this? He's walking on the beach, and there's this tub of some metallic goo. It's like an experiment from the Navy. This thing explodes, and he gets a shrapnel in his chest, and this goo fills the wound, and it looks like a sword on his chest. And then he learns he can mentally manipulate it, and he becomes like this...
Kamehameha.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he becomes like this... He morphs the goo into this armor so he looks like a traditional Hawaiian warrior, and he basically proclaims himself to be the true hero of the islands, and he tries to run Superboy off, and just basically... I'm trying to think of an analogy from Spider-Man. He's kind of like the Scorpion in a way that, you know, he can be a threat, but after his initial appearance, he just ends up working for sundry other bigger or more powerful villains in the series. But just the look of him, you got this native Hawaiian who doesn't like Superboy, and they become enemies for no other reason than the fact that this guy just can't get over himself, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we said Knockout, they're a scavenger. I almost want to say Brimstone, who's a character that came, I think we first see him in the Legend series from the 1986 or 87, who's basically this giant, is a walking volcano created through apocalyptic technology that Superboy and the Ray fought in an issue of the Ray series in the 90s, and just the image of Superboy trying to fight a walking volcano is kind of cool.
And also, you know, one of my other favorite stories of this era is World's Finest 3, where Superboy and Robin team up to fight to fight Metallo and, believe, Poison Ivy?
Yes. I think so, yeah.
And this is the first story that says that Superboy is vulnerable to kryptonite.
Yeah.
Because by making his genetic structure as Kryptonian as possible, and by the fact that his body absorbs solar radiation just like Superman's for power.
But, what? He's encountered kryptonite before, and he's shrugged it off.
Well, that was before a certain writer asserted his Kryptonian DNA.
Well, no, in World's Finest 3, they had Tim Drake used the kryptonite ring to slow down Superboy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I remember in the comics they tried to... Well, he's... Before World's Finest, he's encountered kryptonite before, and it doesn't affect him at all.
That is strange, because World's Finest 3 had Kessel working on it.
I don't... One villain we should mention, and this goes back to... the women in Superboy's life, was Amanda Spence. And Amanda Spence was like this evil geneticist who worked for... Oh, God. It's Missy. She worked... It was some...
The Agenda.
The Agenda, which was like this genetic agency, like evil genetics organization. They loomed large for a great portion of the series, specifically when Superboy was working at Cadmus again. And she's the one that... Tana Moon, if as much as Match was the Bizarro for Superboy, Tana Moon was Lois Lane. She, you know, because she was a reporter, you know, had Superboy's eye, you know.
She killed Tana Moon.
Yeah, Amanda Spence. I mean, she kidnapped him, and this was all in and around Sins of Youth.
Yes.
Because it was like right at the end. I think it was just right at the end in the epilogue issue of Superboy, where, you know, she hits a switch and. Basically, yeah, fries her brain, and then Superman's, because Superboy was Superman at this point, he hadn't reverted yet, and he goes in, he's just ready to throw everything to the friggin' wind. It's like,
and he heat visions at her, but she teleports out of the way.
Yeah, and then there was later on when she did get captured, and Superboy was, like he was lost his powers and he couldn't do anything, and then I think his Wonder Girl said something that basically made her pee herself. But it's just this you've seen it in a dozen like horror movies, action movies. Amanda Spence is one of those really snotty, slimy, I'm smarter than you and I'm evil and everything I do, you'll never beat me. It's just one of those ones, because she keeps, for so many years, because it was 2 or 3 years before she was ultimately dealt with, she just kept getting away with everything. She was almost a Lex Luthor.
Actually,
in some respects.
The Lex Luthor character in that, in the Superboy part of the mythos, was really Lex's ex-wife.
The Countess?
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean...
She had her fingers in all those pies back then.
I still can't believe that, you know, Lex Luthor was married at some point. I mean... But with Spence, like I said, she's just like one of those slimies. Like, I'm going to get away with everything. And you almost think she was going to get away with everything for the longest time. And then she finally got caught. And I mean, Superboy's fought a lot of other... Like, he fought King Shark, where I don't think they ever really developed him on in other books beyond the fact that he was just like this mutant shark. But then they kind of toyed the idea that maybe he's the son of like one of these Hawaiian gods, you know, out of the Hawaii, the cultural mythology of the islands, which I thought was really cool. And then when you look at some of the other, and getting into later on in the run, like when Superboy went back to work at Cadmus as an agent of Cadmus, and they had the story where, I forget, what was the impetus for Superboy of becoming the command, he became commandy for a few issues. And he was...
That was back when... I love those issues, by the way, because...
Was that after Hypertime?
That was before Hypertension.
Okay. Because they had this great run where Superboy was, you know, he lands on this mysterious island, he loses his memory, and it's basically the series in that time where he's working for Cadmus was this great love letter to all the stuff that Jack Kirby came up with. Like, you know, they reasserted the whole DNA project aspect of Cadmus. They... introduced the wild men in this island where it's essentially where, while Superboy lost his memories, he was basically Commandy, the last boy on Earth, and he met like Prince Tufton and the wild men, and they had stuff like, well, they had the supermodel who got scarred on one side of her face, and she became
Jonah Hex.
Yeah, she was a reincarnation. She was like a descendant of Jonah Hex, which, interesting idea, I will admit, in execution not so much.
She had a stone dragon with her.
But everything's cooler with a stone fire-breathing gargoyle named Brock. But, I mean, that was one of the things they go... When he's on the islands with the wild men, they bring in, was it Nosferatu, who's, like, this humanoid vampire bat lady. And then some of this time they had stuff, and then they had, like... They get sucked into space, and they had Cossack, who is, like, this intergalactic... like slave trader, and it was like one of those guys. Like when you listen to him talk, like when you read the speech bubbles, you almost hear like Tony Jay's voice, like this incredibly deep, hypnotic voice coming out of this guy. What was the name? There was a storyline where basically Superboy and the thing is Roxy get into like an intergalactic cannonball run style race.
That was a great one too. That's one thing you'd always count on in Kessel's run was was a sense of adventure.
Yeah,
that's what I loved.
Sorry, what are you saying, Red?
Said that's what I loved about the Superboy comics was all the adventure.
Well, that was a great thing in like the mid to late 90s. Like that is like say what you will, and I said this in like one of our first episodes. Been the 90s for me with a lot of comics. In a lot of ways, is reflective of the spirit of the Silver Age back in the 60s, where they were trying a lot of crazy stuff, and it didn't all stick, but some of it was just plain fun. And you really can't not have fun in your comic the way they did when you're using stuff that Jack Kirby came up with.
Yeah, and like I've always said, is I always thought that to me... The Superboy run that Carl Kessel and Tom Grummett did, it's especially Tom Grummett's work, because Tom Grummett somehow mixed...
He channels Kirby.
No, he not only mixed the Kirbyism, you know, you have the Kirby cackle, you have lots of Kirby-esque designs, But he also somehow molded, you know, Tom Grummet molded also with it lots of the senses of perfection in design from John Byrne. And the thing is, if you ask someone what are the two most incompatible art styles from two classic comic artists, it would be John Byrne and Jack Kirby. But here's this guy, Tom Grummet, who was able to marry them perfectly.
Well, yeah, it's like you have like the design aspect with all the crazy technology of Jack Kirby with the very fine details oriented throughout. I mean, even look, like you said, one of your favorite characters, the Guardian, was a creation of Jack Kirby, and they brought him in and redesigned him somewhat after a while, that, you know, to great effect. And when you look at characters, like, I don't think there was ever a Silver Age comic using the character Grock the Gargoyle, but you look at the work that Tom Grummet put into designing him with, like, you almost think that this guy was a cousin to Ben Grimm.
I know.
Just with the stone skin and everything. And a lot of the crazy, like, DNA aliens that Dabney Donovan created in his run, who, again, one of the best villains in the series.
He made, you know, he made a fire-powered, flame-shooting, giant clawed Jack the Ripper clone.
Yeah.
Because he could.
Well, why wouldn't you?
That was actually one of my favorite things in this run, was also the brief time that that you know, Jim Harper, the Golden Guardian, had a partner.
Heatwave.
Heatwave, the reformed Flash villain Heatwave.
Until a certain writer decided to fix that.
Yes. I mean, let's wrap up here. And like I said, I love the Kessel Grummet Superboy. And I think that saying this is a character I think I have emotional connection to is an understatement. I mean, this is a character I really feel about, and this is a character, like I said, when Geoff Johns got his hands on him, I felt betrayed by DC Comics. I felt that DC should have done a better job of safeguarding the legacies of these characters they created.
Well, that, I mean, that's one of the great things, like we said this last little bit about the series, is they, one of the best things about it is, you know, they had this love of Jack Kirby. I mean, and it came in so, or like, naturally in the story.
Exactly.
Because it wasn't until after, like, Superboy went through his commandy phase, and that was just before he went back to, you know, work at Cadmus, and that's when they really started bringing in the Kirby aspects, you know, in the art and the story and all that. But like we said, it's, there was so much fun to be had in this series. Like, granted, there wasn't always the great stories in Hawaii, but I mean, that was the growing years.
I think that was a concept that was in the back of the head that didn't really fruit as well. I think the Cadmus years were some of the better years.
Yeah.
But, Red, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, to me, it's basically, what's that, a love letter to Silver Age Superman comics. And that's what I loved about most of the Superboy series. And I'm a Superman fan and a Superboy fan, and it was pretty much Superboy comics that turned me on to Superman. Without them, I would...
Same with me.
Yeah, and I have a passion. I feel passionately again about Superman, especially with the new Zack Snyder films and stuff like that. And now they're... The new 52, how they're basically ruining him.
Worse.
And,
You mean where the first Superboy is dead and now they're using an alternate timeline version of him?
No, it's not just that. It's Superman himself. He's just, he's not Superman anymore.
He's a dick.
Pretty much. And they want to make him dark and moody like the Batman, and he's not Batman.
And he's a character that's his own creation.
Yeah, he's supposed to be inspiring. He's supposed to be what we all can be, what we all can strive to be, and he's not anymore. They took that away from him. And if it wasn't, like I said, I can't articulate it as passionately as you can, Ben, but that's why I mostly listen to your podcasts and chime in once in a while. But
the way I put it is, it's a sign of immaturity if a writer thinks the way to make a more mature superhero is to make them act more childish.
No.
And because the thing is this, these power fantasies, these getting off on being able to mess with people, these are terrible things. I mean, the whole idea and concept of Superman, in by extension Superboy, is, yeah, I have the power to do this, but to mess with somebody, but why? What does that get me at the end of the day? That doesn't do anything. I mean, a great example of this is, I'm going to bring up again, is the Superman trade graphic book, Superman Secret Identity, which doesn't star Superman or Superboy.
Superboy Prime.
No, it's not. Have you read it yet, Red?
I'm reading it, and I haven't read it all.
Well, there's a scene in the first issue where you have this young Clark Kent just get his powers, and he's getting picked on by this bully, and he's thinking about, well, you know, I could hurt him, but what does that get me? That doesn't get me anything.
Yeah. That's the essence of Superman, is he's selfless.
There's no point. There's no point in being petty, because it's like, it's almost as if by getting those powers and being a good person, you realize there's no point in the petty little shit stuff. You know, it's like, okay, a guy threw his beer can at the back of my head. It didn't hurt me. Doesn't matter.
Well, he's the classic hero. He doesn't need a dark origin. He doesn't need his parents to die to feel his fucking goodness, right? He's selfless.
Exactly.
He doesn't care about... Well, he cares. That's the whole pro. The whole thing.
Well, that's one of the part things about, like, in the Young Justice comic, is aside from the super, you see him mature emotionally as the series goes on.
Yes.
And that's what we're losing in comics today, is characters that just give a shit.
Well, that's... Yeah, I mean, that's...
And that's the one thing that's the one thing we could have always counted with the old Superboy is he would do whatever he could do to save you, because he doesn't care about that petty little stuff. He might the thing is, he was immature. He might rag on you a little bit, but he's not going to not save you.
Yeah.
Suffice to say, we have not seen the like of this series in many years, and we might never see it again.
Absolutely, and that is a shame. And like I said, it's Superboy is what got me into comics and what got me into doing comics.
Same here.
Well, I think that on that somber note, let's sign off, guys. This is your host, Ben.
JT from Saskatoon.
Red Ink, random fan.
And we're saying goodnight.
So long.
Peace out.
I'm sorry, JT, if you think my Geoff Johns rants are too mean or too harsh.
I don't think they're too mean or too harsh. I agree with a lot you say, but I am more forgiving than you, obviously.
Well, the problem I have with Johns is not only his attitude as a writer, because we've seen writers do this shit before. It's usually the fans that regulate themselves to the point where they call it out. Where the fans do the calling out, but with Geoff Johns, there's very few fans calling him out on this. And that pissed me off more than anything else
about
this whole thing, because the fans usually do a good job of self-regulating, where they go, oh, this writer's shit. He ignored what the previous writers did. He ignored what was great about this character. The fans usually do a great job of self-regulation, but for this, they let me down. The fans let me down. The community let me down. Big time. And I felt betrayed by that. And I think it's because too many people are so fucking in love with Geoff Johns and his stupid JSA run that they think it's cure fucking cancer.
Well, to me, it's not the fans. I blame DC Comics myself. I blame corporations. They're all about the quick buck, and that's what Geoff Johns has been doing, is making money off the quick buck.
I know. But
basically, look, Hal Jordan's back. Buy a bunch of comics. Barry Allen's back. Buy a bunch of comics. And
but like I said, to me, usually the fans do something. The fans
they
say
do.
Something. But they didn't with this one.
They fucking got Cassandra Cain back, for fuck's sakes.
I know, but they didn't with Superboy. They let Geoff Johns do his thing with the half Lex Luthor DNA thing, and I was a voice, and they told me to quiet down. What Geoff Johns was doing was great, because he had this JSA run.
Yeah.
Well, the first thing that I think is wrong with that statement, for people telling you that, okay, I'm kind of a fan of Geoff Johns. Ben knows this. I enjoy some of the stuff, a lot of the stuff he's done. I'm not so much an apologist. I mean, certainly there's scads and scads of evidence that the guy's a dick, but I just want to read some comics, and if I'm entertained, you know, that's my thing. But to try and negate Ben's argument, well, his work on this book was great, so shut up. I was like, well, how does that impact anything else? Like, if you're arguing about justice, well, no, if you're arguing about Justice Society and you want to even talking about, you know, whatever, great writers, arcs, runs, whatever, well, fine, bring up Geoff Johns' run. You could use that there. But if you're talking about Superboy, the fuck are you doing bringing up Justice Society? Because
this happened a lot.
Swear
to God, when Teen Titans first came out, I was vocal. I was fighting people. I was talking about it. I told you, I had an issue Superboy number 0 that someone refused to open up and see I was right because they wanted, in their mind, to know Geoff Johns was always right about the continuity. Because Geoff Johns was the guy that made hot continuity make sense, so he was always right. These are things that people say to me. I felt like I was a silent voice for the longest time.
You weren't. You just didn't know me back then.
Thanks, Red. That actually means a lot, but...
No, there's some things with the new Superboy. There's a few stories that I do like.
With the new 52?
Not the new 52. Like the new Geoff Johns Superboy. Like, what the fuck is that? After he died and he came back, there's an issue where...
Oh, like the Adventure Comics run?
The right before that. The fuck is that? Infinity Crisis? Some Crisis? Whatever the fuck Crisis it is.
Well, he died in Infinite Crisis, and then they brought him back in Legion of Three Worlds mini, which was like a spin-off thing going into or just after Final Crisis.
I think it was Brightest Day, maybe. That's what I'm thinking of.
Okay.
Like, there's a little moment in there where Crypto is basically kicking his ass, and he's like a zombie fucking whatever. So he can think, but he can't stop himself.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're, I guess in their zombie form, they can see emotions. They can see the color of emotions. And there's this one
like auras or something.
Yeah, there's this one moment where Crypto is basically fighting for Superboy, trying to take him down, but at the same time, trying to help him. And he's describing Crypto. He says like he's like a shooting star. He feels pure emotion. And it's basically, it was a comment. It was a story that brought tears to my eyes because, for the longest time, him and Crypto were buddies and shit.
I know, and I did enjoy that aspect. Technically, that was something that that Geoff Johns brought in. But you're right. But like I said, it's to me, like I said, the part of me that's most angry about this is I felt alone. I felt alone for the longest time because he was this character that I loved. I was taught that the comic community, if something like this happened, if there was some old bullshit that a writer does, they band together, and even if they can't change the mind of the company, they can, like, silently, you know, they can, like, be in pain together and help each other and feel better about it.
Yeah.
And the next writer could possibly, undo the damage, but what I got instead was pipe down, shut up, Geoff Johns is right, you're wrong. Geoff Johns wrote this JSA run that shows he's better at understanding continuity than you are, etc., etc., etc.
Well, I got a situation where I was hanging around with people, and basically it was a chat line, or an RPG chat line. And Geoff Johns' new run just hit, and Teen Titans just hit, and the moderators of the room were basically forcing everybody to follow that fucking storyline. And I refused just because Impulse was shot and I didn't like it. I didn't like the changes they made to Impulse. And I used to talk to people all the time. I didn't really play in the RPG. I hung around because my friends were there, and they always talked about comics. And they were always telling me I was wrong. This is how it is now, and shit like that. It's pretty much just like you. I couldn't get my voice heard. And
well, we found each other now, so we know we weren't the only ones. And if anyone, I might include this in the show. If anyone out there hears this, felt the same way, leave a comment. Let us know we weren't the only ones. Because I felt alone for the longest time. I really did. I mean, I was on the comic book resources forums. I was arguing day in, day out. And I was told to shut up and sit down.
Yeah. Well, I never went to those forums. I just don't know what chat lines me.
I know. But I was. And that was, to me, was the biggest betrayal. Because when I came into comics, I was taught that the fan community, when something as heinous as that happens, they get together. And like I said, if they can't affect change to the company, they at least suffer together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I was basically told that it was better. That the old Superboy was stupid and this new Superboy was better.
I was told the same thing, too. I was told this is exploring parts of him that, and I'm like, this is stuff that he already went through with Paul Westfield.
Mm-hmm.
He went through 30 issues of angst. This is retreading old shit because some guy decided that his fan theory deserved merit of being published, and he didn't have the basic courtesy of trying an even basic retcon. He just pretended that it was always this way.
Mm-hmm.